Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Senate confirmation hearings for the new Attorney General Loretta Lynch, who was grilled by Republicans implacably hostile to President Obama and the current Attorney General Eric Holder. Nancy Zirkin, the Executive Vice President and Director of Policy at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, who was at today's hearings, joins us to discuss how the United States Attorney for Brooklyn handled the difficult position she is in as a nominee and as a surrogate for the administration that is so hated by many of the senators on the Judiciary Committee questioning her, in particular Senators Ted Cruz, Mike Lee, and Jeff Sessions, along with Senator Vitter, who has already threatened to block her nomination. Then we'll look into the hostage situation in Jordan, where the government has agreed to negotiate with the so-called Islamic State, who are holding a captured Jordanian fighter pilot along with a Japanese journalist they are threatening to behead unless a 200 million ransom is paid and an Al-Qaeda suicide bomber is freed and swapped. Kurt Ryan, a professor of political science at Appalachian State University and a Fulbright scholar to the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan, joins us to discuss the overwhelming support in Jordan to make a deal to release the pilot, which gives the Islamic State leverage to play the Japanese off against the Jordanians. Then finally, we will speak with Michael Hiltzig, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist at the Los Angeles Times, whose latest article is The Disneyland Measles Crisis, How to Make Negligent Parents Pay. We will discuss the measles outbreak across the nation and in California that began at Disneyland, where 50 cases are linked to exposure in the happiest place on earth, and the paradox that parents who refuse to vaccinate their children based on anti-science hysteria are often from affluent and educated communities in Marin and Orange counties. And joining us now is Nancy Zirkin, the Executive Vice President and Director of Policy at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights and the Leadership Conference Education Fund. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nancy Zirkin.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for having me on here tonight.
Well, it's a pleasure, Nancy, and you were at the hearings today for the nominee, Loretta Lynch, to be the next Attorney General of the United States. But it seemed that so much of the hearing was focused on beating up on her predecessor, the current Attorney General, Eric Holder.
Yes, let me say that the atmosphere at the in the room, which is one of the largest rooms on Capitol Hill in the Hart Senate Office Building, was electric. Many of her sorority sisters from the Deltas were there. It was a sea of red. She has tremendous support, and she is extremely well qualified. But you're right. The questions really went to the person who wasn't in the room, and that was Eric Holder. It seemed to me that the Republicans were obsessed with trying to have her answer questions on what she would do vis-a-vis Holder. What she said over and over again, as any attorney general would, that she would safeguard the rule of law, protect the public, and ensure fair and impartial administration of justice for all Americans.
So tell me about just to touch on what you mentioned, the sea of red. What's the sorority, and is it a nationwide sorority?
It is a nationwide African-American sorority. It is huge across the country, and they wear red to signify that they are Deltas. We had a past president there. We had a huge showing for them. Ms. Lynch had been a Delta, as a matter of fact, had founded the chapter at Harvard a number of years ago, and it is a service sorority, very active in their communities and very well respected throughout the country.
And she was Loretta Lynch was accompanied by her father, who has been active in civil rights movement, along with her husband. She is, of course, the U.S. attorney for Brooklyn. And she's getting an enormous amount of endorsements, isn't she not, from police chiefs and other law enforcement officials?
She is, in fact, getting huge kudos from that from that whole community. Former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani, New York Police Commissioner William Bratton, former FBI Director Louis Free, and countless others support her nomination. And as a matter of fact, there was a letter sent to the Senate Judiciary Committee from many, many former, both Republicans and Democrats, former U.S. attorneys. There is no question that Loretta Lynch is beyond qualified to be Attorney General of the United States. She has demonstrated very well her ability to defend the law, including prosecuting some of the most notorious cases of police brutality in New York City.
And again, I'm speaking with Nancy Zirkin, who's Executive Vice President and Director of Policy at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights and the Leadership Conference Education Fund. She attended today's Senate Judiciary Committee hearings on the confirmation of Loretta Lynch for Attorney General of the United States. Now, already before this hearing began, Senator Vitter of Louisiana had promised to block the nomination. And clearly there are a number of senators on this committee who are implacably hostile to President Obama, that, of course, and some of them are running for president, I might add, Senators Ted Cruz, Mike Lee, and Jeff Sessions. I believe that the hearing started off with Chairman Charles Grassley asking her about the Attorney General's holders' immigration policy and whether she would uphold it. What you just told us about her law enforcement credentials, you would think in the current atmosphere with terrorist attacks on people's mind and also the police brutality incidents across the country, also that have been in the news, it seems like they were focusing on other things.
Absolutely. They were focusing on what the president did in his executive order. She has written that she believes that and said today he did not exceed his authority. Had he granted total citizenship and to all 11 million, that would exceed. But he drew a very narrow line. And I think what the Republicans are trying to do is make the distinction between Holder. And the fact of the matter is that because Eric Holder was front and center in this, that demonstrates to me how much antipathy they have towards him. And remember, he's not leaving until she is confirmed. So it should be, since they demonstrated yet again their issues and problems with him, that should be an incentive for them to confirm her as quickly as possible. But we will see.
But did they ever specify, or have they ever specified, why they are so unhappy with Eric Holder? I mean, is it the same kind of logic of why they're unhappy with former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton because of Benghazi? They seem to get these sort of obsessions, whether it's Benghazi in Clinton's case or Fast and Furious in Eric Holder's case. But beyond these already endless and somewhat discredited investigations into these phony scandals. Is there any substantive objections that anybody ever put forward about why they hate Eric Holder so much?
I think you have summarized it very well. They have hung on to several things that are unfounded, that they are very angry about, including his enforcement of voting rights, including intervening in the Texas case on voter ID, including intervening in North Carolina. We in the civil rights community applaud General Holder's doing this and really being a beacon of light in the protection of civil and human rights.
So they're not ashamed of saying that they are angry that somebody stood up for voting rights?
I can't speak for them.
But was there any manifestation of that attitude in today's hearing?
In terms of voting rights, I think it was questioned, but I really can't comment on that.
Sure.
They stuck to the script of immigration and attacking Holder. And I think Lynch said many, many times she will uphold the law and the Constitution countless times.
So, apart from the Democrats who are now in the minority, was there any sense that there are some Republicans that might support her?
Well, I don't think the questioning was as harsh as I would have expected. Even as it was, there are obviously ones that are going to oppose her. That's clear. Vitter will. I imagine Cruz will. I'm not as convinced Sessions will. Lee could very well oppose her. But we will just have to watch this play out. And the witnesses tomorrow on the Democratic side all know her, have known her for a long time. So it will be a very interesting hearing. And I ask everybody to please listen and let your senators know how you see it.
Well, Senator John Cornyn, the Republican of Texas, he actually asked her, you're not Eric Holder, are you? And right. She replied, no, Senator, I'm not. And apparently there was some laughter in the room as a result of that.
That's right.
So what is your sense of where Cornyn stands? He's pretty influential, is he not, a former judge?
He is, and at this point, frankly, I don't know where any of them stand. I'm waiting to hear just like everybody else.
And that would include Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, Orrin Hatch of Utah, and Jeff Flake of Arizona, who are the ones that there's an expectation that they will support her.
Right, but I don't think anybody has really shown their hand.
Right, but when
I look forward to it.
But when you say, though, Nancy Zirkin, that as long as they don't confirm her, Eric Holder stays in the job, is that Obama's leverage here? Is that his ace in the hole?
Based on how they attacked the Attorney General today, I would say so.
And in terms of just in closing, then her qualifications, which appear to be pretty stellar, that was not an issue, or was it brought up? Or did anybody come out in her defense, or will that happen tomorrow?
It is acknowledged by everyone on the committee, I believe, that she's highly well qualified. The issue that they kept going back to was, will you act like Eric Holder? And that was the central issue today.
And if they vote against her, but she squeaks by, is this a straightforward majority vote, or what's the threshold on this vote?
51.
So if she gets 51, could Vitter still put a hold on it?
Any senator at any time can put a hold on any nomination before the vote.
And Vitter has not said that he said that he will do that, but has he now said that he won't?
No, I don't know. I know that he's trying to drum up support against her. And we look forward to seeing the rest of the hearings and to see how the process plays out. And I thank you very much.
And I thank you, Nancy Zirkin, for joining us.
Bye-bye.
And again, I've been speaking with Nancy Zirkin, who's Executive Vice President and Director of Policy at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights and the Leadership Conference Education Fund. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the Jordanian fighter pilot held captive by the so-called Islamic State, who the Jordanian government have said that they will negotiate over his release.
تني بجوز عيونه على صمار الحنطاوي
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Kurt Ryan, a professor of political science at Appalachian State University, specializing in international relations and comparative politics, with particular interest in Middle Eastern politics, Islam and politics, and international terrorism. He's also a Fulbright scholar to the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan and the author of Jordan in Transition from Hussein to Abdullah and Inter-Arab Alliances, Regime Security and Jordanian Foreign Policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kurt Ryan.
Thanks for having me.
And clearly things are very difficult at the moment for the Hashemite Kingdom. I imagine they're getting squeezed in all directions from the U.S., from Japan, and from the Islamic State, who are threatening to execute a captured Jordanian pilot, which I understand the Jordanian people are very, very concerned about, and they want a deal made. And the Jordanian government has offered to make a deal to swap an al-Qaeda terrorist for this pilot. So what's your understanding of where things stand now?
At the moment, as far as I can tell, the negotiations are ongoing. It does seem like the state has made the decision to at least negotiate with the Islamic State, known as Daesh, in Jordan, to try to secure the release of their pilot. He was went down over Syria in a jet fighter in December, and ever since that time, there's been a lot of outpouring across the country of people who are for the war or against the war, but very concerned with his safety. His name is Mawat al-Kasasba, and so there is a hashtag with his name, that we are all Mawat, among other things, where people have been, and in fact, even in Japan, using the same hashtag, have been in sort of in solidarity with him. But I think now it's gotten to the point with the tensions rising that there have been demonstrations for 2 days in Jordan to try to get the government to go ahead and negotiate a swap, including even for an al-Qaeda terrorist, to get their pilot back.
So does this suggest then that the Jordanian people are not enthusiastic about Jordan's involvement in this anti-Islamic State or Daesh coalition, of which clearly the pilot was a casualty in the sense that his plane was shot down while participating in bombing runs against Daesh?
Yeah, it's. I would say it's very, very controversial. It's hard to know the exact figures. I know there are some people in the regime itself who feel that they have polling numbers suggesting that they have lots of support. But, you know, everyone I know who's more on the ground, and whether journalists or scholars or activists, has seen a tremendous amount of tension. People are really torn. There are some who think that this is rough, but Jordan's got to do what it's got to do, that it has to put up a fight against the Islamic State, or will go the way of Iraq or Syria, or it has to stop them where they are, at least, so it doesn't go any further. And, you know, they, unlike the United States and Japan and other countries, they are, of course, next door to this. It's attached to them, so the stakes are much, much higher. But there are many Jordanians who are very critical, who are not supporters of ISIS or Daesh at all, but nonetheless think that this is not Jordan's war, that it's getting dragged into something that it shouldn't be. It's getting implicated with countries like the U.S., and in effect what they've worried about all along is that maybe this would invite, for lack of a better word, ISIS retaliation against Jordan, that it would visit terrorism on Jordan. And the irony is what they have in mind is the bombing in 2005 by al-Qaeda suicide bombers, and that is the exact terrorist who we're talking about swapping for the pilot right now.
And that bombing at a hotel killed 60 people, did it not?
Right, and it was a kind of, it was al-Qaeda in Iraq was behind it. So all the bombers themselves were, of course, suicide bombers. They were all killed in the bombing except for this one figure, Sajida al-Rashawi, who's either did not detonate her suicide vest or it didn't work. I think the trial suggested the latter of the two, and she was convicted and is in fact on death row in Jordan, has been in prison ever since the 2005 bombings. But it bombed three hotels simultaneously, killing 60 people, wounding hundreds. And Jordanians refer to this as their 9/11, as that sort of critical, horrible moment of terrorism that has not then occurred since, but many felt that the war against ISIS might lead to this exact kind of event. So it's, I suppose, ironic then that we're talking about this exact figure being the one that would potentially be released to ISIS to get the pilot back. But that probably also should be read as a measure of how much outpouring there has been for the pilot to just bring him home, as a son of Jordan, bring him home.
And again, I'm speaking with Kurt Ryan, a professor of political science at Appalachian State University, who specializes in international relations and comparative politics, with particular interest in Middle East politics, Islam and politics, and international terrorism. He's also a Fulbright scholar to the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan and the author of Jordan in Transition from Hussein to Abdullah, and Inter-Arab Alliances, Regime Security, and Jordanian Foreign Policy. But I guess, in a way, this whole situation brings up the kind of schizophrenic nature of U.S. policy as well, right, towards the Daesh and the Islamic State, both in Syria and Jordan. On the one hand, we're sort of allied, in effect, with Iran against Daesh in Iraq, but we're helping out enemy, the Assad regime in Syria, by bombing the most effective military force that Assad's facing. So right, how do the Jordanians feel about that schizophrenia, that, and the fact that they've been swamped with refugees, at least a million, which is straining this already fragile country that already had an earlier influx of Iraqi refugees?
Right.
They don't have the water resources to cope with this influx of refugees. So it's a very, very critical situation. So one would think that Jordan basically is concerned about what's happening in Syria. And so what is the average Jordanian's understanding of the Syrian situation?
Well, hard to say. I mean, there's a lot of difference of opinion, but you're absolutely correct that they're deeply concerned with it. And then again, in the sense that this is a country next door. Syria is the northern border. Much of the eastern border is Iraq. So they pay very close attention to both of these. And they're wedged in even more complicated ways. To the west is Israel and the Palestinian territories. So the Jordanians are in an incredibly uncomfortable neighborhood, to put it mildly, with security concerns in every direction. And that's all the more reason that many have felt that by all means bolster the borders, by all means increase security and preparedness in the face of ISIS, but not necessarily actively join the coalition. But I think there was a tremendous amount of Western pressure to do exactly that, and there's yet been frustration in Jordan that the U.S. has, to use your term, been rather schizophrenic, that it is supposedly against Assad, but only partially, And they have pointed out, not just the Jordanians, but I think many people in the region, that focusing an aerial campaign, for example, against ISIS in Iraq, but not so much in Syria, has no real chance of ultimately defeating the organization if their main strength is really in Syria itself, and it also may somewhat accidentally empower Assad or even Iran. And the Jordanian regime, certainly, and many people in the society are concerned about Iran's hegemony rising in the region as well. So they're wedged between Iranian ambitions, the ambitions of ISIS, even their allies, Saudi Arabia to the south, or their distant allies, the U.S., even Japan, putting pressure on them to do more than they're really able to do with any kind of political wisdom. So they, I would say Jordanian policy has tended to be and still is characterized by trying to walk a kind of tightrope down the middle of whatever the options tried to be. And they know that a hostage swap is not a great solution, but I would say that they, both state and society, have come to the conclusion that it's the least bad solution that is out there, that all the alternatives are perhaps even worse. So at the bare minimum, let us, the Jordanians, at least get our one pilot home. And then after that, I expect it to trigger a whole new debate about Jordan's connection to ISIS, no matter how this shakes out.
Well, of course, it won't just be getting the pilot back and handing over this convicted al-Qaeda terrorist whose suicide vest failed to explode. It would also involve money, because Daesh, the so-called Islamic State, have asked for a lot of money, I think $120 million, and it's difficult to, you know, distinguish the Japanese prisoner from the Jordanian prisoner. I take it there's an effort to kind of make a package deal, and that would, to my mind, put Daesh in the catbird seat. Are they manipulating the Japanese, playing them off against the Jordanians?
I think there's a danger of that. At the moment, there is a Japanese delegation in Jordan that has been actively negotiating but also working closely with the Jordanian authorities. They have an operations room, meaning a Japanese operations room, set up in Amman to deal with this hostage crisis. The two countries have very close relations. Japan has just contributed a tremendous amount of money to Jordan to help with the burden of Syrian refugees. But there is a danger, at least, that much as they want to cooperate, and they have been, the worst possible scenario, I think, would be if ISIS is simply playing both, and ultimately neither hostage is released, and at worst are both killed, and they're using this as a horrible publicity opportunity. Best case scenario they can hope for, I think, is that a sort of three-way negotiation works, and with a combination of a release of a key al-Qaeda figure and probably cash from Japan, that both the Japanese hostage and the Jordanian hostage pilot are somehow released. But either way, I suppose, yes, propaganda-wise, I'm sure ISIS will declare a great victory, but there will be nonetheless, if the pilot is able to come home and the Japanese journalist is also released, there will be an enormous sigh of relief, to put it mildly, inside Jordan. I think it's fair to say that the entire country is on edge watching every moment of this play out.
And there are, of course, precedents of countries negotiating with Daesh or ISIL, the French, for example, and clearly money changes hands. That seems to be the only way you'll save somebody from having their head chopped off on television.
Probably. I'm not sure. I mean, I think even the critics, you know, countries like the United States, which will be very, very critical and have clearly pressured Jordan not to make this choice and have pressured their ally Japan not to make this choice, but they're not in the position of having to make it. And both countries will, I think, very quietly say the name of someone like Bo Bergdahl and say, well, there are times when you, the U.S., negotiate as well. And we realize that in principle this is not a great idea. It may embolden ISIS, but there's so many domestic pressures and so many other reasons that are pushing them in this direction that there are, as I say, people who are either very supportive of the campaign against ISIS or have been harshly critical who are nonetheless riveted to this process. And even the pilot's Muwatta's family has been part of the demonstrations the last 2 days. They were at one of the royal palaces earlier today, and there was an unofficial report that they may have met with the king himself, who was reassuring them that at least something was underway, even though there are no guarantees about its outcome. So I think we're kind of on the pins and needles stage of this to see what happens next.
Well, the father of the captured pilot who ISAF's or Daesh have offered up in exchange for this captured al-Qaeda terrorist was responsible for the attacks or an attempted attack on her part, but the successful attacks which killed her husband along with other jihadist suicide bombers killed 60 Jordanian innocent citizens. There was also a wedding party that were among those that were killed, and you've described that as Jordan's 9/11. But nevertheless, the father has gone on television saying that his son, the pilot, when Moath joined the Air Force, he did not join to fight outside Jordan.
Right.
He thought he was a Jordanian pilot to defend Jordanian airspace. We never knew that we will be going, we'll be joining other countries to fight outside the Jordanian borders. So is that father's attitude reflective of the Jordanians, which is that, you know, they don't want to get involved in other people's fights?
I think to some extent, I think there are a lot of, I guess I would say this, a lot of people I've talked to in officialdom will say, no, that's an unusual, almost sidebar. But in my experience, at a more, I think from a more grassroots level, perhaps, that's actually a very pervasive sense. There are people who have no love for ISIS, but nonetheless don't think this is Jordan's role, that Jordan shouldn't be doing this, that that's not what they signed on for. And in a family like that, for example, where there are number of members of the family are very proudly serving the state, it's very common for the same family to have people in the armed forces, in the police, in the government, serving at different levels. But this is an unusual step for Jordan. Jordan plays a huge international role, even for a tiny country, plays a disproportionately large role in international peacekeeping. But to cross its border and actually launch airstrikes is extremely unusual. It was a very unusual step, and hence the controversy. And so I think the argument that King Abdullah II has been making, and I'm sure he had this discussion with Muawiyah's father recently, was that this is so great a threat that Jordan can't afford to not be fully engaged. But even so, while he makes that argument and many people agree with him, there are many others who think that, no, this is, they need to be stopped, yes, but this is not the way to do it. We are not the ones to do it. We need to focus on our own borders and within, but not, in effect, cross them and engage them more directly. So it's still controversial at bottom line.
But Jordan's foreign minister says that there is yet no proof that the pilot is still alive. So, and I believe the Japanese are also concerned whether or not the journalist that's being held is alive. And
right.
They've asked $200 million for him, and they've executed his friend and forced the Japanese journalist to hold up a picture of his colleague's severed head.
Yeah.
So where does that stand? I mean, this is what they call proof of life. Do you know anything on that front?
I haven't seen anything new. Earlier today, they were circulating, and of course, a lot of, you know, we're getting a lot of social media reporting on various things that turn out to be false leads, but there were pictures circulating that, you know, may or may not have been true of exchanges already happening on the borders, of the Japanese delegation already arriving at the Syrian border. Wasn't clear if an exchange was happening, and, you know, and so on. But I did see that interview, and I saw, I believe the foreign minister of Jordan, Nasser Judeh, was, among other things, trying to temper expectations and reminding people that this is not over, that they are at least on record saying, look, we're going to try this, controversial though it may be, we're going to try to negotiate to try to get Muath home. But we, the Jordanians, have been asking several times for several days and really for several weeks of some kind of proof, and it's not been forthcoming at all. So the best of my knowledge, there still isn't any clear proof, which is, as I said, that would be the worst scenario that anyone, no matter where they are in this situation, that would be the most devastating, is if there's nothing ultimately to negotiate here and ISIS has already carried out yet another heinous act.
And there's no way to know that, really. I mean,
no.
They've made it pretty clear that they operate beyond the bounds.
Yeah.
And that, of course, is why there's a sort of, I think, a somewhat hysterical reaction to them here in the United States. I was just talking to a reporter the other day who covered the Freedom Summit of all the Republican perspectives, or many of the Republican perspective presidential candidates for 2016 were up in Iowa over this last weekend, and they were all talking about how the Islamic State is threatening, and, you know, the farmers of Iowa, for God's sake. So, you know, there's a lot of, I guess the point I'm trying to make here is that the Islamic State is awfully good at tweaking us.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And so I think here the debate is, as controversial though as it may be, especially outside of Jordan, really, it's easier to judge it from outside and say this is a terrible policy, you can't negotiate. But for those actually in the situation, in a small country that's rubbing up against both Iraq and Syria, where ISIS fighters have tried to cross the border into Jordan several times and have engaged Jordanian border forces, and the country that has dealt with this kind of terror attack come back in 2005, it really, to put it mildly, hits close to home. It's, you know, for them, it's very different from your example, right, where it's a real concern for them. It's a serious concern, a security concern, and it's hard to know what to do best, which is why I think even people who disagree with each other within Jordan at least acknowledge that they may or may not agree on the policy, but they can see that there aren't any actual good ones. They're selecting from a list of bad alternatives in a very difficult regional situation, and this is yet another thing on that, another on their pile of decisions to make. So if they could get him home, there will be a national celebration. If they can't, it will be really demoralizing for both the regime and its critics at the same time.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us today, Kurt Ryan.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Kurt Ryan, who's a professor of political science at Appalachian State University. He specializes in international relations and comparative politics, with particular interest in Middle Eastern politics, Islam and politics, and international terrorism. He's also a Fulbright scholar to the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan and the author of Jordan in Transition, From Hussein to Abdullah and Inter-Arab Alliances, Regime Security and Jordanian Foreign Policy. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Hiltzig, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist at the Los Angeles Times. He received the Pulitzer Prize for articles exposing the corruption in the entertainment business and currently writes the twice-weekly column Golden State, covering business and economic issues relevant to life in California. His books include Colossus, Hoover Dam, and the Making of the American Century, and The New Deal, A Modern History. His latest article at the Los Angeles Times is The Disneyland Measles Crisis, How to Make Negligent Parents Pay. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Hiltzig.
Thank you, Ian. It's good to be back with you.
And it's good to talk to you again, Michael. And this epidemic of measles that's across the country, but mostly concentrated in California, and in many ways it appears to have begun at Disneyland, otherwise known as the happiest place on earth. There are at least 50 cases have been linked to Disneyland. There seems to be a bit of a groundswell now countering this personal belief exemption that allows parents not to vaccinate their children and allows them to go to public and private schools where they can endanger other students. It seems to me that a lot of parents are waking up to the fact that their children are being endangered by these parents.
Yes, I think that's so, and I think a lot of factors have come together here. First of all, clearly in California and perhaps in other states, the personal belief exemption for childhood immunizations has gotten way out of hand. California tried to tighten things up a little bit last year by requiring that a doctor or a neuropathic doctor or an osteopath or even a school nurse sign off on a parent's claim that they had a personal belief. But in a state like California, it's so easy to find a medical professional to put their signatures to one of these documents that it's not really an important restriction. We have some schools where 10%, even 20% of the children in kindergarten aren't immunized because their parents have claimed this sort of exemption. And I think what happened is that the rate of these exemptions grew over time because nobody thought that the prospect of some of these diseases was very real. Measles formally was judged to be eradicated from California, from the U.S. back in 2000. Periodically, there would be a resurgence, but nobody really took it seriously. Now they're beginning to take it seriously. They're learning once again that measles can be a very, very serious disease with lifelong complications if you get it.
Well, I was just reading a story, Michael Hiltzig, of a parent up in Richmond, California, with a young child, and you know that you can't immunize children under 2 for measles. So young children are particularly vulnerable, and this parent has to keep her child in the house all the time because there's the measles in the neighborhood. And if this child were infected by measles, as you just pointed out, the complications range from pneumonia, which can be lethal for an infant or a young child, to encephalitis, which the Center for Disease Control advises can lead to convulsions and can leave a child deaf or mentally retarded. So the risks are very high. And again, this gets back to the idea that this personal belief exemption, which is based on anti-science hysteria, is, in other words, the freedom of some parents to exercise their, sort of new age nonsense. Other parents have to pay the price.
Well, they do have to pay the price, and I think there's more attention being devoted to the question of how do you make a parent pay the price? I mean, in today's science, it's entirely possible to trace an infection of an unimmunized child or, as you said, an infant back to a source through epidemiological studies. Who's responsible? These personal belief exemptions, they're based on no science whatsoever. I mean, look, it's one thing if you have a religious belief, if you're a Christian Scientist or some other sects, which have long histories of disapproving of certain forms of outside medical care. Those people maybe have a right for their beliefs to be considered, but that's not going to be a lot of people. There are many patients who, for medical reasons, can't be immunized. I mean, real medical complications that could occur if they get some of these immunizations. That's also a small number of people. But for somebody to say, I just don't believe in it, I don't think the science that tells me that vaccines are safe, I don't trust it, that's not enough. We really have to quarantine these children, and we really have to quarantine their parents from taking these sorts of steps that produce a public health crisis in the rest of the community. And that's exactly what's been happening. And I think that's helping to turn the tide against the freedom that we've given, the tolerance that we've allowed personal belief exemptions to have.
So in terms of making negligent parents pay, you quote the science writer Alex Berzel of USA Today in an op-ed saying parents who do not vaccinate their children should go to jail. I take it that's a little harsh.
Well, that may be the extreme viewpoint. There are others, other ethicists, who say that you can make a case that parents who do not get their children vaccinated today, given the huge weight of evidence that vaccinations are safe and certainly much, much safer than getting the disease, that they could be charged with child neglect or child abuse. And then the other option is to subject them to the civil courts. As I said, there's a tort here. They have a responsibility to protect the community from their own actions, and it may very well be actionable if your child gets sick because one of his classmates has not been immunized because of a personal belief exemption. Then do you have a case against that parent? In some states, it's been established that you do.
And you've, in your article in the Los Angeles Times, Michael Hiltzik, you have a graph of public and private schools that show the extraordinary rise in unimmunized children from the year 2007 up to 2014, with public schools starting out in 2007 with 1.4%, I take it, of children not immunized, and it's risen to 2.9% by 2014. And in private schools, it's even greater. It's gone from 2.6% in 2007 up to 5.7% in 2014. And that raises the question about this peculiar paradox that amongst educated and affluent parents, there seems to be a greater concentration of these so-called personal belief exemptions, in particularly clusters in Marin County and Orange County.
That's right. Marin County, Orange County, you see it in Santa Barbara County as well. Curious phenomenon. Essentially, what's happening is that you might think on the face of it that one reason that we might have a low immunization rate in some schools is that parents can't afford to get their children immunized. That really doesn't seem to be a major factor, especially now when the Affordable Care Act provides for free immunizations as one of the core benefits in preventive care. But what you do see is parents who basically they're educated enough to and they have the ability to access a wide range of information, but they don't have the expertise to distinguish real scientific studies from junk science, the science that's pervaded, new age science, whatever you want to call it, that's out there that tells them that, gee, you know, there are real dangers in vaccines that you aren't being told about. They have a certain amount of pride in thinking that they know something that the rest of the community doesn't. And as a result, you get these pockets of non-immunization, of anti-immunization sentiment in wealthy, well-educated communities. And also as a result, you see real outbreaks. The focus of the outbreaks of this latest measles measles occurrence is in a lot of these wealthy, well-educated counties.
Well, since we've been on the air having this conversation, Michael Hiltzik, the phones have lit up, and it's probably as a consequence of the fact that at KVFK, at this radio station, there have been a lot of anti-science, new age programs promoting medical fraud and ideas such as not immunizing your children. So it's alive and well, and I know it's awfully difficult to convince people who believe in conspiracy theories that they're simply wrong and that there are some valid scientific evidence, because people that get obsessed with pseudoscience, there's volumes and volumes of stuff that they claim supports their point of view. It's the same thing with the 9/11 truthers. They have reams and reams of conjecture about Building 7, and I mean you go crazy trying to wade through it all, because you're dealing with a belief system that's very rigid and very inflexible, but very real.
Well, that's right. And there's another aspect of this that I think is important to keep in mind, because it goes to the question of how do we eradicate this, or how do we turn it around. There have been several studies that have shown that when you actually deliver real hard scientific information to many of these people, that doesn't change their mind about immunization. And in some cases, it may even cement their opposition to it. So they do have these belief systems. They identify with these belief systems. They identify with this community of anti-vaxxers, as they're known. And it's a very strong bond, and it's very hard to break. And one of the points that I've been making in my reporting on this is that it may be that the only way to break it is to through social pressure and peer pressure, really make resistance to immunizing your child socially unacceptable.
Well, what about getting rid of these personal belief waivers? They didn't used to exist.
Yes, I think that's very important. Our government, our medical regulators, really have to play a very strong role in this. Our legislature really should close that loophole. Our medical regulators, the Medical Board of California, they should make it clear to their licensees, pediatricians and other doctors who get their licenses from the medical board, that purveying this sort of non-scientific advice, to telling people to delay or to avoid immunizing their children, really calls into question their devotion to the standard of care of their patients and should put their licenses at risk.
Well, I've covered this issue a little bit with the science writer at MIT, Seth Mnookin, who wrote the 2012 book, The Panic Virus. And he believes, and I take it you do, that a number of celebrities like Jenny McCarthy and Oprah Winfrey have helped spread this anti-science nonsense that is so dangerous. And because of this measles outbreak, it ought to be clear to everybody that that there are real consequences for this kind of New Age dogma.
Well, I think that's absolutely right, and I've written about that, as you know. The fact of the matter is that our entertainment industry, our TV industry these days, simply doesn't exert the kind of discrimination that it should when it's dealing with these complex subjects. So, yes, Jenny McCarthy went out a few years ago. She decided that her child, who was autistic, acquired his autism because he was immunized with the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. And she's written books, she's gone on the air, she's been presented by Oprah Winfrey. Oprah more or less vouched for her point of view. She's gone on Larry King. She was featured in a cover story in People magazine. And none of these outlets really made the effort to delve into the science and the non-science that Jenny McCarthy was purveying. They just basically treated it as, this is an opportunity to present a celebrity to our audience. It will get us ratings. We'll promote the celebrity. We will get promoted in return. It was unbelievably irresponsible. And really, we need to hold these sorts of people to account. Oprah, Jenny McCarthy, Larry King, People magazine, this is dangerous stuff they're peddling, and they really need to be responsible about it.
Well, but Jenny McCarthy in particular, her beliefs of the MMR vaccine, measles, mumps, rubella, caused autism was based on this bogus study that's been thoroughly discredited by the Lancet in England, and I believe the British fraudster that put it forth, Andrew Wakefield. I thought actually he might have been jailed. I certainly know that he's been discredited thoroughly.
Well, he's lost his license in the
UK. His license. Is that what it is? Yeah.
He now lives in America. He lives in Texas, I believe. So he's still around, but he can't practice medicine. But yes, if you trace this notion, this canard, that the MMR vaccine is connected to autism, it all goes back to a study that he conducted in the UK. And one of the reasons that he lost his license was because it was shown that he conducted the study, he aimed to show this connection because he had a financial interest in that outcome. So it was unbelievably irresponsible. It was plainly fraudulent. It was exposed as a fraud. But it lives on because it's got a bizarre logic that people who are predisposed to resist immunizing their children will seize onto. And that is really hard to eradicate a lie on that scale. As I believe Winston Churchill said, a lie can make it halfway around the world before the truth can get its boots on. And I think that's what we're dealing with.
So has either Oprah Winfrey or Jenny McCarthy ever apologized or ever retracted their support for anti-science?
Well, I've never seen anything showing that Oprah has fessed up. Jenny McCarthy last year publish a column or an op-ed in the Chicago Sun-Times in which she claimed that it was a misconception that she was anti-vaccination. But if you really looked at what she was saying in that op-ed, she really was, she wasn't anti all vaccination, but she said she was against the vaccination schedule that's accepted in medicine. And then many others who had interviewed her at the time when she was purveying this anti-vaccination point of view, it came out and said, look, you know, we interviewed her. She was firmly against vaccination. She absolutely tried to connect the MMR vaccine to autism. So she tried to back down, but her record is really clear.
Well, but just to begin with, the idea that people in America get their medical advice from a former Playboy playmate, an MTV star, and a talk show host, Oprah Winfrey, I mean, that's pretty pathetic to begin with.
Well, we have a celebrity culture. Look, we have actors and actresses who play the old line, play doctors on TV, who are called to testify before Congress about medical issues that maybe their fictional characters deal with on the air, and there they are, giving supposedly learned testimony to Congress. That's the world we live in. Everybody, wants to associate themselves with a celebrity. Celebrity is cheap in this country. It doesn't take much to become one. Certainly, Jenny McCarthy hasn't shown, Meryl Streep-level talent as an actress, and yet there she is on the air all the time.
Well, Michael, I'm sure we are both going to get lots of mail saying that we're shills for Big Pharma. That's usually the response that you get from people who have such firm, albeit ridiculous beliefs in this anti-science. Because, as I say, it's really hard to shake once people decide that 9/11 was an inside job and Building 7 was blown up by explosives to rescue Bush and Cheney's presidency. At a certain point, you can't deal with the barrage of pseudoscience that allegedly supports these views. So I don't know what can be done here in terms of pulling over these educated, affluent people who are putting – it's not a question so much of putting their own children at risk, but they're putting the children of others at risk.
Well, that's what's really irresponsible about it, because – they really are creating a public health crisis. Look, in our culture today, some people find great comfort in being part of a community that questions authority, that doubts institutions. And in this case, and in other cases, they're doing real damage to their own families and to others' families.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today. Michael Hiltzik, again, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist at the Los Angeles Times. He writes the Golden State column twice a week and is the author of The New Deal, A Modern History. His latest article at the LA Times is The Disneyland Measles Crisis, How to Make Negligent Parents Pay. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.